Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sex is potent, combustible, planted deep in human nature. But is it addictive? Tiger Woods has become the latest celebrity to suggest so, checking in for rehab. But is sex addiction real? Is it an excuse for philandering? Is it a genuine affliction? You won't find it in the American Psychiatric Association's newest diagnostic manual. But it may be in the next one. This hour, On Point, we'll take a serious look at sex addiction. You can join the conversation. In the age of instant online porn and the hookup culture, is sex addiction a real condition, a real problem? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A gentle warning to listeners across the country, we're talking today about mature subject matter here, so heads up on that. Joining me now from Royal Oak, Michigan, is Kenneth Adams, clinical psychologist and certified sexual addiction therapist. He's treated patients for 25 years and has seen, by his count, some 5,000 sex addicts. He is clinical director for the Program for Sexual Health and Addiction, an outpatient program that treats sexual compulsion and addiction. He's co-editor with Patrick Carnes of Clinical Management of Sex Addiction. Ken Adams, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Snoqualmie, Washington, is Pepper Schwartz, professor of sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle, where she teaches one of the school's most popular courses on the sociology of sexuality, author of dozens of books and academic papers on sexuality, consultant to the Luminari Women's Health Network. Pepper Schwartz, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thank you to have me. It's great to be here.
So, Kenneth Adams, first to you. I guess the whole world is maybe getting pretty tired of Tiger Woods, but everybody heard his apology last week and has seen all the reports of the many affairs. Just for starters, does this look like sex addiction to you?
Well, you know, I don't know the whole story, of course, other than what everyone else has heard, but it's a classic representation of what we call sexual addiction, people who have lost control, who cross boundaries and take risks that people shake their head at and have serious consequences as a result. Not speaking for him directly, I'd say that it certainly is a possibility.
A possibility. He's gone off to some kind of therapy or rehab. We don't know exactly what it is, Pepper. Does this look like a candidate for therapy or just, you know, marriage counseling?
Well, I'd say, you know, I think your other guest is being very cautious about a clinical analysis when you don't know the person in real life. But basically, this guy has had a life that's been out of control, that was galloping towards self-destruction, and which, if he hadn't been sort of soaked in his own grandiosity and hormones, he would have logically, this is a smart, talented guy,
mm-hmm.
would have logically wanted to spare him what has happened. And He couldn't. I think the gravity of this particular situation is how many women he was seeing, how many balls he had in the air, how much it had taken away from every other part of his life, how self-destructive it was. And I think part of the things we don't know is how unhappy it made him at some deeper level than we can look at from the outside. But yeah, I think if we were going to look for somebody as a sex addiction poster child, he probably would be the guy.
But Pepper, you've been in this field for a long time. You've been helpful and informative to us on many occasions. And I think that for a long time you were skeptical about the very idea of sex addiction.
I have been, and I still remain so under some circumstances, because addiction to me has a very strong physiological component, as we've instructed before. In other words, if I get off heroin, my whole body goes into convulsions or some other drug that has a physiological component where there's pain and suffering. You know, should I change my behavior? But I have been reading a lot more of the hormone literature lately,
mm-hmm.
and I do see a feedback loop here, where you're getting a very strong reinforcer, you know, all the hormones of sex, testosterone, oxytocin, dopamine, and that when you stop getting that reinforcer, you probably are going to have physiological cravings and problems like that. So I think the question might be more, is addiction the most useful way to look at it? And certainly, I'm sure even I and I would agree with most people in that field that you could certainly have extraordinarily compulsive behavior that you would need help to change.
It's been controversial over the years whether or not to call this addiction. It's still not in the DSM that way. I guess it's being considered for a future addition. Kenneth Adams, I mean, you're a certified sex addiction therapist, so sexual addiction therapist, so you obviously see it as a reality. How do you define it?
Well, you know, I think the better question here is, as opposed to whether it exists or not, is who are the sex addicts? And having done this for almost 30 years now, I can tell you that we have clinically significant withdrawal symptoms when people stop acting out their behaviors. Shakes, sleeplessness, the kind of things you see with drug addiction as well. So your earlier guest mentioned that, you know, she was skeptical because of the absence of that. But in fact, we have that.
You mean, are you saying that some kind of, body chemical reaction upon denial is necessary to classify it as an addiction?
Well, that's the classic part of the definition of addiction in the field, absolutely. And in terms of your reference for the next diagnostic manual, it looks like the phrase hypersexual disorder is going to be the one being used, and it's strongly considered right now. And the reason that's even being considered is because of all the work by sex addiction therapists who have worked hard to call attention in the field to a group of people whose relationship to their sexuality is extremely disordered and characterized by the classic signs of addiction, powerlessness, escalation, tolerance, and we have some evidence now because of the increases in brain imaging that, you know, we have changes in the brain going on. We have increases of dopamine. We have resetting of the dopamine points where it the addict needs more and more escalation in order to get the previous level of arousal. Loss of control, consequences, and in spite of the consequences, the inability to stop. And the other classic thing that we see with sex addicts that we don't see in the normal population typically is sex addicts are almost rigidly drawn to and needing high-risk or sexual situations in which they're in charge, in which control and power become the aphrodisiac. And they tend to be under-aroused with normal, intimate, vulnerable situations. So it's not uncommon, for example, to see somebody very hypersexual who falls under this category of sex addicts with everybody but their partner. And so with their partner, their partner's needing a sort of sense of vulnerability, closeness, and they can't or have struggles getting aroused. But when they're in control, when there's little intimacy, they have high arousal. That's a classic representation of sex addicts. And we see that quite a bit.
You're saying intimacy and sex actually become divorced, though we normally think of intimacy and sexuality as twins.
Well, in this case, for sex addicts, there's a split between love and lust. And lust becomes a secret compartment in which the purpose of being sexual isn't about sex. It's like a food addict. Somebody who's always grazing on food reports that they're always hungry, but they can't be always hungry. But the brain has gotten wired in such a way is that now the impulse to eat is connected to anger, loneliness, boredom, a range of feelings that have nothing to do with eating. And the same is true with sex addicts. Sex addicts will report that they feel hypersexual. I'm just more sexual than the average guy. This is just normal. You know, what's wrong with doing this? And really what they're reporting is sexualized feelings, feelings which aren't meant to be sexualized.
Pepper Schwartz, is this a continuum? You know, is it sort of, there's sort of, I don't know, normal sex, whatever that is, that's pretty broad. But then there's a whole lot of sex, and then way, way more sex. Is it a quantity continuum? Is that what determines sexual addiction? Where's the line between just, you know, let's say a very active sex life and sexual addiction?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I do think that there is a line somewhere, and it's going to be very gray. It's going to be very, very much cultural to some extent. I mean, there was a time in history when any woman's sexual urges were seen as bizarre and something to be treated. You know, the turn of the century, they used to have clitorectomies in England to remove sexual organs from women who they thought were mentally ill because they had a sexual interest. Uh-huh. Now, granted, we have progressed far from those kind of barbaric reactions to sexual urges, but nonetheless, you could see, and I think a good clinician, like the person we're talking to, would see that there would be room for abuse when someone's sexual response and interest and number of partners might offend someone else's morality, but not be sex addiction, but called sex addiction because it wasn't someone else's scale of what's okay. So I think that some of the kinds of very clear demarcations would be necessary so that we don't get in the morality business rather than clinical treatment of somebody who has so disordered their sexual response that they can't react in normal situations and are unhappy and driven and causing themselves ultimately pain and suffering rather than pleasure, love, attachment, things we think are good for people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sex addiction. It's in the headlines, but is it real? After 45 days of rehab, here was Tiger Woods at a press conference last Friday apologizing to his supporters and shouldering some blame.
I was unfaithful. I had affairs. I cheated. What I did is not acceptable, and I am the only person to blame. I stopped living by the core values that I was taught to believe in. I knew my actions were wrong, but I convinced myself that normal rules didn't apply. I never thought about who I was hurting. Instead, I thought only about myself. I ran straight through the boundaries that a married couple should live by. I thought I could get away with whatever I wanted to.
Tiger Woods, last Friday, he went on to say, I felt that I'd worked hard my entire life and deserved to enjoy all the temptations around me. I felt I was entitled. Kenneth Adams joins us this hour from Royal Oak, Michigan, a clinical psychologist, certified sexual addiction therapist. Been in the field for 25 years. Pepper Schwartz is with us, professor of sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle. She's written up and down about human sexuality. Kenneth Adams, I'm reading here. This is from Suma Garvey in the Ottawa Citizen. She's a sex and relationship therapist. And she says, you know, this Tiger's no sex addict, she said. She's writing here. He's like any other young, fit, aggressive guy full of testosterone. Men who can often do. Tiger is as human and sexual, she writes, as the rest of us. She says it's addiction when the need overrides everything else and renders the individual unable to function. She said, here's a guy, you know, his golf game never faltered. He was the top-ranked golfer in the world. You can't say that he was not functioning. He was functioning.
Yeah, well, I think that's a little bit limited scope around how to look at this. And, again, we don't have all the facts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a continuum of addiction, and we have stages of addiction. And we have people, for example, who are alcoholics who are functional. That doesn't mean they're not alcoholics. So I think your emailer there is really not tending to the whole story. Now, I think that sex addiction is largely defined by behavior and consequences and escalation. And clearly in his statement there, I think what you were hearing is some of the treatment approaches you'd get in a sex addiction treatment program that kind of blends therapy with 12-step focus, where there has to be some self acknowledgement, mm-hmm. responsibility, and you certainly hear his narcissism and his entitlement. And sex addicts, like other addicts, drug addicts, alcoholics, have personality disorder issues that kind of color the deal. But I don't think this is about hormones. I don't think this is, certainly it plays a role. And I don't know if we tested his testosterone, if he'd have a little more than the average guy, perhaps. But this goes beyond that, I think. And again, we don't have all the facts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm loath to diagnose him as a sex addict. But clearly his story, as your other guest has said, is probably a poster child. I mean, excessive behavior. I mean, really, if you look at this, what was this guy thinking? I mean, he had the world to himself, which certainly increased his entitlement. But why would he do something like this if he didn't have some compulsive, distorted relationship to her sexuality? He's in essence, ruined his marriage. Who knows what's going to happen there?
Yeah, certainly his family has had bad consequences. But Pepper Schwartz, again, this is Sue McGarvey, the sex therapist in Ottawa. She says, Tiger's much more of a narcissist behaving badly than a sex addict. And then she goes to the issue of kind of celebrities hiding behind, potentially hiding behind the, you know, addiction thing. She says it gives any philandering spouse the get-out-of-jail-free card. It feeds into what I see, she writes, as the American Hollywood culture of victimhood. To admit he committed multiple indiscretions of his own free will doesn't lend itself well to sponsors and public. To say he has a problem that a month in the Betty Ford Clinic will fix makes him a fallible hero. A hideout, Pepper?
Well, you know, there's always that possibility. It's hard from far away. But I think that submitting to a label, to going in for treatment, is a hard thing to do, particularly for a narcissist,
particularly for
someone who thinks they're entitled to control the world. That's not the kind of thing that this person would do unless they were so humbled, not just from the consequences, but from their own behavior. It's a shocking realization, I think, in any kind of behavior to say that you are, to yourself, that I am out of control, that I am not the master of the universe, that I have screwed up my personal life, that in his case I've lost millions of dollars, which could have gone to his charity, which you know could have had some other outcome. There's a list of consequences he now has to recognize, and I think at that point when he says, you know, I cannot do this alone. Maybe for some people it's cynical, but it doesn't strike me as cynical because it's not just to save your marriage to do this. You don't want to see this over and over in your life. You know, there's some sad celebrity stories where you see them in and out of rehab because they can't conquer the thing that's bedeviling them. And I think to some extent when they do this, they are saying, I can't control this. And, you know, who knows who's cynical and who isn't. I think that in general, if they start out cynical going in there, what's going to happen to them there is not going to remain cynical because they're going to penetrate several layers of psychological defenses.
And it's not just celebrities. We'll talk about that and treatment and the role the Internet may play in this more widely. I want to turn to our callers, a lot of them here. Mary in Iowa City. Mary, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
You know, I think this is the biggest joke there is in the world. Now, Tiger Woods gets up there and talks about his sex life because he knows one thing. This is what white people want to hear. You know, this black man and his oversexed life, and he wants to get back in the game. And he never had an adolescence. He played golf, him and his father, golf. So he never had a chance to date or even see what women were about. And finally, he wants to get rid of his wife. Nobody ever talks about this. And if he needs a doctor, the doctor's name is Dr. Feelgood. And all these references to balls and penetration and so on and so forth. Even listen to your show, it's funny.
It's funny, but, I mean, what white people want to hear? Is there nobody in the African-American community who wonders about what's going on with this guy and, you know, his sex life?
No, because it's sex and titillation. Back from, you know, the religious atmosphere we have now goes back to the founding of the country. You've got to control the sexual urge. And even USAID, when it was taken over by the religionists, we can't have any condoms. They have to, you know, abstain.
Yep. Mary, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Thank you. Mary, let me get one more right here from Montreal in Canada. Ed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. When I heard about Tiger Woods, I thought of Rasputin, the man who was cavorting at the court of the Russian Tsar a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm saying this is I think he, just like Rasputin, in a way, Tiger Woods represents an age of decadence and an age of excess that we're living in. I mean, we're all addicted to something, whether you're a workaholic or a shopaholic or a sexaholic. It symbolizes, I think, Tiger Woods' behavior symbolizes the excessive behavior that we're all driven towards.
We're all addicted to some kind of excess. Maybe he certainly sort of pins the needle in that category. Though, you know, he's no Wilt Chamberlain, said 20,000, or what, Warren Beatty, like, what they wrote 12,000. I don't know. Ed, thanks for your call. David in Belmont, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
As a psychiatrist, I am a little skeptical about the whole concept of addiction with regard to sex therapy. I don't think we need to invoke addiction. I think that someone like Tiger, without knowing any of the tremendous details, we don't need to invoke addiction to recognize a spectacularly self-destructive pattern that we recognize in a host of different personality disorders. And people have already mentioned narcissism. There are other personality disorders where a host of psychological factors from his upbringing, from his life, from ambivalences about his success, and perhaps a deeper desire to sometimes destroy that success.
Those are all good points, but David, let me ask you, as a psychiatrist, why would you shy away from the word addiction? Is there some problem with bringing this into that category?
Well, I think, you know, there are lumpers and splitters, and, you know, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is a useful tool to help us think about discrete disorders. Addictions in general involve physiological effects, involve withdrawal. In my experience, I've never seen it. I don't believe that there's a significant body of literature to support the idea that, you know, cessation of sexual activity leads to withdrawal, even in the most hypersexual of individuals. And I've treated many hypersexual individuals. So I don't think we need to invoke it. There are many well understood psychological factors involved in the kind of self-destructive behavior we've been talking about. There's an old saying that narcissists and people with other kinds of personality disorders create the abandonment that they fear the most by their behaviors. There's an underlying self-destructive pattern that needs therapy, needs treatment. Sexuality is only one final common pathway. It could have been gambling. It could have been drugs. It could have been a host of other behaviors.
David, it's great insights, and I appreciate it. We will look at those as well, and I thank you for your call. Let me get one more. A caller from the Boston area, pseudonym, I guess. Frank. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself a sex addict. I attended the same treatment center that Tiger Woods did, spent 45 days there a year and a half ago.
But this is the Gentle Path program at Pine Grove in Hattiesburg, Mississippi?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
I have to say that there's nothing that ever helped before in really facing the truth about how destructive this was in my life and what I was really doing, and that I couldn't get out of that alone. To me, the key definition of addiction that matters to me is when someone can't stop, even if they promise themselves sincerely over and over that this is the last time, I'll never do this again.
What told you that you had a problem, Frank?
Well, I was discovered in my marriage, and that blew things up. And then a therapist eventually said, you really need to go.
And what
treatment?
And he recommended the place in the Mississippi, the Gentle Path. What was that program like? What did it consist of?
Well, yes, she did. It's an extraordinary thing. First of all, because it's full-time, 24 hours a day, I've never worked harder in my life. So much writing, so much reading, so much introspection.
Writing what? It's kind of a diary of your offenses or sexuality or something?
Well, they're not offenses because none of these people are sex offenders.
I don't mean it in that way, sorry.
But yes, a diary of your whole sexual history, but also trauma history. There's reasons people end up in compulsive destructive behaviors. And to me, it's clear from my own experience, I'm not a doctor, but from everything I learned is that it comes from avoiding painful feelings, from medicating feelings, because otherwise no one would do this over and over and get themselves deeper and deeper into a hole.
What's the message, the prime message that they gave to you that maybe Tiger Woods heard there?
Well, I heard a lot of the messages in his presentation. I mean, the language he used was so familiar to all of us who go to these 12-step meetings or who were lucky enough to attend a treatment program. Humility and recognizing the absolute truth and 100% honesty, because anyone who's been doing this has been living a double life with secrets. And living with secrets, to me, now I understand, it can't work. You can't be in an intimate marriage if you have a horrible secret life that you're desperately defending and hiding.
Do you still go to a 12-step program around sex addiction, Frank?
I expect I'll go the rest of my life.
Is it well attended? I mean, plenty of others.
Yes. Oh, yes, and there's new people all the time. And it's always a wonderful thing, even though it's sad to see a new person It brings new life to the group because it reminds all of us of where we were. Helping others is one of the key things that gets anyone out of themselves. So service is an important piece of it.
Is it like AA? Do you stand up and say, you know, I'm Frank and I'm a sex addict?
Oh, yeah. And actually, in the group I go to, we run down our list of behaviors. Because part of it is sort of detoxifying the secret and getting over the whole shame and saying, look, this is what I did. And now I deal with the consequences. But I need to move forward and get my life in order. I'm not a bad person, you know, from here on out.
Are you on top of it now?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Last thing I wanted to say, though, is withdrawal is a huge part of all of these programs. Everyone recognizes that withdrawal is an extremely common process that's incredibly painful for some people. For myself, it was a little bit less than for some. Others, it's just overwhelming for months. And if that's not addiction, you know, I don't know what is. It's because we do create all those pleasure chemicals in our brains, and it just escalates. And the last thing that I never hear these days in all of the press about this is that many people who are in this are just doing pornography. They haven't progressed to, you know, voyeurism or affairs or other things. But if you are compulsively spending hours and hours and hours and hours on pornography,
and especially with the internet these days,
swearing you'll not do that again. What a waste of my life. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then the next day you find yourself back on it. And Patrick Carnes calls the internet the great accelerator because it's so available now.
Even there in the realm of sex and pornography. Frank, thank you for your candor.
If you have a moment, Tom,
yes.
Both our last two callers, I think, bring up the essence of some of the debates. And the value in looking at addiction as both a conceptual and a diagnostic issue, as is true in our field, is it steers treatment, right?
It
steers treatment.
Steers or directs.
Yeah, it directs treatment. And so I would respectfully take issue with the psychiatrist. First, we have lots of literature about withdrawal. I don't know about lots, but there's literature out there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if he keeps looking, he'll find it. And, you know, if you remember back in the 50s, you know, there was very well-meaning psychiatrists and other professionals who said alcoholism wasn't an addiction. It wasn't a disease. It wasn't a disorder. It was an issue of morality and will. In the meantime, there was a group of people who said, enough of that. We're going to go off and we're going to find a way to help ourselves. Mm-hmm. I have a problem. I can't stop. And they began to form self-help groups. That self-help movement began to influence the treatment field. The same thing is happening here with sex addiction. So we have lots of people like Frank, who was very brave, and I commend his willingness to do so, who have been gathering for years, who have gotten my attention. And they say, look, your treatment methods don't work. And at least they don't work well enough. I can't stop. But if I go into a recovery program and I wrap the addiction paradigm or model around my problem and I say out loud that I'm powerless over some behaviors, now I have a chance. So that's the value in reference to your previous caller, why you use the word addiction under certain circumstances. And admittedly, I think that people have hidden behind the sex addiction or other addiction labels to escape responsibility and have overused it. But that doesn't take away from the value of it.
I want to come back.
That's why I said earlier, and I'll get out of your way, that it's not is there sex addiction, it's who's sexually addicted that is the better question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sex addiction. It's in the headlines again on the back of a celebrity case, a big one this time. In the case of Tiger Woods, he's been in therapy himself and very much in the public eye, maybe more than you care for. But the issue behind it is interesting, and it's got some real depth to it. We've been joined by Kenneth Adams, clinical psychologist, certified sexual addiction therapist. He's with us from Royal Oak, Michigan, and from Snoqualmie, Washington. Pepper Schwartz is with us. She's professor of sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle. It's very much in the popular culture these days. VH1 has a show out there, Sex Rehab with Dr. Drew, follows addicts through a 21-day rehab program at the Pasadena Recovery Center. Here's a clip of British filmmaker Duncan Roy talking about his addiction to internet porn.
Because I am a very creative, passionate man, and my world shrank down to my desk and to the internet and three sites, because, you know, that's what life became. You know, in the same way that life becomes a line of coke when you're doing drugs.
A line of coke, or internet porn, or many, many partners. There's just one example. Kenneth Adams, what does treatment look like in this realm?
Well, it involves, as some your previous caller mentioned, some review and look at some of the factors that underlie why somebody gets lost, say, on the internet. Could be depression, could be anger, could be unresolved trauma from family of origin or other abuse issues that's being played out in that. It could be a marital conflict that the person is escaping from, so marital therapy could be part of the solution to that. Almost always, when we have a legitimate, bona fide sex addict, it involves you know, the incorporation of the 12-step program. In my experience, while it's not entirely impossible to treat a character disorder or personality disorder in therapy, we get a lot better results with addicts as well when we combine the two, when people are doing the 12-step approach along with the therapy.
And are the 12-step groups, like our caller described, common around the country? Are those in most substantial communities?
Yes, they are. There's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, or Sexaholics Anonymous, or Sex Addicts Anonymous. And the reason there's so many groups, like in our professional circles, and I'm sure your other guests can attest to that, there's a lot of debate anytime you bring up sex. You don't get this much debate about gambling, by the way. And that's because it's the issue of morality and sex. And so you have that in the 12 steppers, as they call themselves as well. You have them debating about how you should recover from this, how you should focus on this. So the issue of sexuality seems to stir most of us, and that's true in the communities as well who are recovering.
Pepper, you've dealt with this in a lot of books, in a lot of forums, but you're also a sociologist. Do you see something about our times that makes us more vulnerable to this, or is just a constant part of the human condition?
Well, it's not a constant part of the human condition when you don't have the opportunity. So the opportunity is essential. You can't be a internet porn addict unless you have internet porn, and that's pretty new evolution in life. So, yeah, it's very sociological. And it also, to some extent, exists in a culture of plenty. If you have to work 12 hours a day, you know, to have enough food on the table, you're not going to have these kind of issues. We have all kinds of compulsive behavior in this country now and in this culture now that are afforded by the lives we can lead. I look at, if we wanted to use the word addiction, and I sometimes am squeamish about that word in many ways, mm-hmm. but I understand its utility. We could look at food, where everybody watches The Biggest Loser on TV. Well, how do those people get to 350, 450 pounds? I mean, they wouldn't be able to do that in a famine society. And we have a kind of privacy in the society, a way of living parallel lives that wouldn't have happened in other cultures. So this is modern in the sense that all technology and all culture changes how we can act and how we will act.
It's out there. People are aware of it. Here's from our website. Judy says, I've just found out my husband of nearly 20 years may be dealing with this issue. I just got an STD from him. Liara says, sex can be an addiction. I've known sex addicts. I've also known all other type of addicts. Is it any wonder so many are driven to behaviors that distract them from reality these days, I guess? Pat in Columbia, South Carolina. Pat, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask another question about definitions. Mm-hmm. I believe every person I've ever heard of who's described as having a sex addiction is a man. And I wonder why women don't have sex addictions. Or is what we call nymphomaniacs in women, is that the same as a sex addiction?
Pat, let us pick it up. Ken Adams, is there any difference in language or in reality?
Well, there are some important differences. One, of course, you know, women have been shrouded in shame for years around their sexuality, so you have to be careful about labeling here, and there's an extra sensitivity that we keep in mind as we sort that out. Mm-hmm. When women are, quote-unquote, addicted, they tend to be more relational in the way they act that out. So they're more likely to get online and then meet somebody, a stranger in a hotel room, than the man is. Men are more, this is not exclusive now, but men are more prone to images and pornography and so forth.
Okay.
So women tend to be more relational. You know, I've worked with a number of women, and as well as my associates, and oftentimes they'll call themselves love addicts because of the shame associated with their sexual behavior. And they'll work on their love addiction, they'll work on their family of origin trauma, they'll work on their what's called codependency, intimacy issues, but they don't stop acting out sexually. And it's only when they begin to frame their behavior as having some compulsivity sexually as well that they get some opportunities to change. So I think you do have to be careful. There are some differences. But when we see women who have these sexual addictive patterns, they look very much like the man, entitled, narcissistic, perhaps somewhat more dependent in their orientation towards others, but the same level of compulsivity, powerlessness, consequences, the inability to stop, the classic definitions that we see with all addictive or compulsive disorders.
And if you go to one of these 12-step programs, will you find women there in significant numbers compared to men, Ken?
In some, particularly in the Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous programs, you will.
We've had Susan Cheever, the writer. She's been our guest, but she came out in not so long ago, and actually with a book. It's called Desire, Where Sex Meets Addiction, and it was her own story. She's saying, "It's my problem." Samantha, Columbia, South Carolina. Samantha, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to approach it from the woman's side also. First of all, I really love to watch Tiger Woods play golf, and I really am hoping that this works for him because I was a public figure in very open positions where I could, you know, be seen and known. And after a divorce, I went through a period in which I had multiple affairs
mm-hmm.
at the same time. And part of it, I think, was the opportunity because I traveled a great deal. Part of it also was the fact that I had friends who participated and who were very supportive of the reckless behavior. Not that they were at fault, but if you have somebody else doing the same thing, and I sort of thought of Charles Barkley as Tiger's friend and Michael Jordan and some of the big parties that they had. I didn't get caught, but eventually my brain did kick in, and I sought counseling, and I got a really good counselor.
Did you feel addicted? Did you feel that you were in the grip of something you couldn't control, or was this just wild patch?
Well, I don't know how you differentiate that because it was exciting. I think I was addicted to the highs and lows. I loved the sex. And but the highs and lows and the risk taking and probably it was narcissistic having people find me attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe I'm sure my counselor said there were lots of reasons why I was searching that out, but it was very much an addictive behavior. And,
did you back off of it? And are you glad you did not?
Oh, yes. Yes, I went through 3 years of counseling about it and made the decision that the risks were too great. And I used to joke and say, I missed the sexual revolution because I was married. And then when I could participate in it, it would kill you. So, maybe my timing was a problem. But and maybe it was like your other speaker said that you weren't supposed to do things like that if you were a girl, I don't know. But I do think that he has an addictive behavior that he is fighting. And it's real hard when people think that you're really special. And I had that kind of opportunity, which was unusual for a woman.
Yep. Samantha, you're a survivor, and I appreciate your story. We hope he is, too. Thanks for calling. Let me get one more from New York. Jim, another pseudonym, I think. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Okay. What's your story, Jim?
Well, I have a pretty compulsive sexual behavior. I guess you could say I'm a sex addict. It has led to serious legal consequences in my life.
Criminal? What do you mean by that? Have you hurt people?
Criminal. Yes. What was that?
Have you hurt people? Is that what you mean?
No, absolutely not. I was caught in an internet sting, a pornography internet sting thing.
I see. Does that mean you're a pedophile? I mean, regular internet porn isn't a problem, right?
No, it was I tried to meet an underage girl off the internet.
Okay.
Actually.
That's rough.
And that was basically the result of total compulsion and total loss of control in pursuit of sex. And I think people think that, well, you just have no self-control, you just have, you know, loose morals, you have...
Just get a grip.
All these behavioral... What's that?
Just get a grip.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's more than that. And... It's much deeper, and if you look into the research of what they've done with neuroplasticity, you find that there are chemicals in the brain such as oxytocin and dopamine and also the protein delta-phos-B. These cause actual structural changes in the brain, and the brain then is essentially rewired to receive this stimulation, and without it, the brain essentially goes into a withdrawal. Now, to classify it as addiction, to say that it's just the same as drug addiction or alcohol addiction, you know, the terms are kind of irrelevant. And the one doctor said the DSM already holds enough descriptions. Call it what you want. It's as much an addiction as anything else is.
Jim, our time grows short here, but I appreciate your call and your candor as well. Let me get one more. Ann in Waterford, Connecticut. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for calling and having me on the air.
Yeah, sure.
I'm in a relationship that has a sex addict, and we're in counseling and all that. And getting that person to admit to having this addiction, how do you get them there, especially with all the information and the inundated pornography sites and the new pornography sites promoting having affairs and all of that's out there?
And what's the evidence to you that your partner is a sex addict? What will lead you to think that?
Already having the affairs, the countless contacts and text messaging, and it's the pornography sites. It's all of those components are there. It's so easy, you know, to be pulled into that. Especially spending 5 minutes on the internet, you're interacting with people.
Right, have you raised it with I guess it's him? Have you said, hey, you've got a problem?
Oh, definitely. But because not so much that it's an entitlement thing, but it's there. They don't. It's like any addict; they have to reach rock bottom to think that they have a problem.
Ann, our time is so short, but let me take it first to you, Pepper. What's your advice to Ann on how she gets a partner to kind of grapple with this?
Well, I think you know it's the kind of thing where if he's in therapy, he's at least agreed that there's a problem between them. And, you know, it is a question of whether this person just is not, is it a relationship issue, is it? I mean, there's too much unknown here for mm-hmm. me to say anything definitive. There are people who are players. There are people who are all kinds of intense distractions and intensities in their life. I mean, the people who practice 8 hours a day doing ski jumps, you know, that's what they want to do. We don't give it a moral implication.
Mm-hmm.
The difference here is two people are involved. He's made certain kinds of promises and vows to her, which he no longer honors. And yet, if he still wants to be in the relationship, he has to understand that he has behaviors that don't suit or fit the kind of relationship he's promised to be in. And I think in terms of just honoring his word and his world, he might want to say, you know, where do I want to be in this world? And if he wants to be with her,
mm-hmm.
then these kind of behaviors don't fit.
Kenneth Adams, what's your advice to people who may have themselves or have partners in this situation? What have you found is an effective way to raise the issue?
Well, it's almost always consequences, either externally or internally. So if he's having trouble internally feeling at odds with himself, so he doesn't find this to be a problem, but your caller does,
eventually she's going to have to make a set of decisions about her position around all that. And so we get calls from addicts who say, my wife left me, and I should have called you 2 years ago, and I didn't, but now I'm calling because I don't want to do this anymore.
How do you know when it's just a, what we traditionally call the philanderer or a promiscuous partner? I mean,
well, I'll take you back to the, I'll take you back to the criteria. Loss of control, inability to stop, primary. So what you hear from spouses or partners of sex addicts, like you hear of alcoholics and drug addicts, is that it's primary. They're preoccupied with it. They're obsessed with it. It takes up many waking hours of their day thinking about it, and they're not available to relationships.
That's a pretty good definition right there, and a pretty big problem for any person or I guess, couple dealing with that. This has been a really interesting hour, and I'm grateful to all of our callers and to each of you for helping us with it. Kenneth Adams at the Program for Sexual Health and Addiction in Royal Oak, Michigan, author of Clinical Management of Sex Addiction, co-editor along with Patrick Carnes. Ken Adams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And at the University of Washington, Professor of Sociology, Pepper Schwartz, author of The Great Sex Weekend and the Lifetime Love and Sex Quiz Book. Pepper, we're always grateful for your insights. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.